You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 9th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is
The Majority Report.
It is Matt and Mike Monday, folks. And today we have a great show for you.
We are broadcasting live.
I almost forgot. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. We do. That wasn't a lie. I have a great show for you today. John Nichols of The Nation magazine will be joining us to talk about the Bill de Blasio surge, Mike Bloomberg's insane comments about that surge and de Blasio's campaign, and tomorrow's first Democratic primary for mayor, for the next mayor of New York City. Also,
we also have for you an interview with Chloe Angel from Feministing. We're going to be discussing with her the elections in Australia that took place this past weekend. And Australia has a new prime minister, and he's not very good on many issues.
He's awful. He would make America proud. We have an update on you on the many issues in Syria. Things are fast moving. New Russian proposal for Syria to destroy its chemical weapons. We're going to play some clips from President Bashar al-Assad's interview with Charlie Rose. And I also am going to be talking about an article on the role that Syrian anarchists are playing in the uprising against the Assad regime. Really, really interesting stuff. And Matt has a lot more.
We have stories on the NSA and what the Obama administration has done with restrictions that were previously in place before they came. And we also have how the NSA is spying on your iPhone and or Android device, folks. That and more coming up to you. But first,
we have John Nichols from The Nation talking about Bill de Blasio. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay tuned, folks, for Matt and Mike Monday on The Majority Report. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
We are back on the Majority Report. I am Matt Binder.
And I'm Michael Brooks, and joining us now is John Nichols. He's a political writer for The Nation magazine and a one-man machine for saving New York City from Bloombergism and the country at large from a reckless invasion. John, how are you?
I'm fitting you in the schedule, brother. I don't know how effective I am on all these great projects you assigned me, but I'll do my best.
Well, we have faith in you. John, I want to start, for people who don't know this, really, really briefly, I think most of our listeners probably do, there's a mayoral election going on in New York City. Bill de Blasio, who's the public advocate of New York City, is surged into the lead. He's running a progressive campaign on economic issues, which is really the differentiation in New York. Most of New York, on from Bloomberg through all of the mainstream Democrats, are pretty socially progressive. But he's running a progressive economic campaign. And over the weekend, Mayor Bloomberg finally just lost it in an interview with New York Magazine, accusing de Blasio of everything from running a racist campaign to a class warfare campaign. So I want to get into more of the details here, but off the top, John, what was Bloomberg saying in this New York Magazine interview?
Well, he didn't say it formally, but I'm getting the sense he is not going to vote for Bill de Blasio.
All right.
Look, Mike Bloomberg has been the mayor of New York City for 12 years, and the dominant political player in the city. People need to understand this. Folks who don't live in New York, Mike Bloomberg came in and under term limits, he could only serve a certain amount of time. He opened his wallet, launched a campaign, and essentially bought a change in the rules and regulations of the city to let him serve another term. So the guy has sort of rolled over New York for the better part of 12 years. In some ways, he has been a useful mayor. There are many people who can find something they agree with him on, even Bill de Blasio, our candidate here we're talking about a little bit, has worked with him on some issues. But it's quite clear that Bloomberg has a favorite in the mayoral race. That is Christine Quinn. She is the city council president of New York, a very accomplished player in her own regard. And, by most measures in the United States, Christine Quinn would be a liberal Democrat.
If she was running for Senate in Missouri, but we would be supporting her.
What?
I said if she was running
Missouri,
for
Senate. She'd be off the charts, right? But the thing to understand is that in New York City, the divide really is on what you're going to do about a really rapidly widening income inequality gap. Are you going to, and this is very, very simple calculus, are you going to tax the rich or not? And Bill de Blasio has bluntly said he's going to tax the rich. He is proposing an increase in the upper limit on taxes, not a dramatic one, but one that he suggests will gather about $500 million a year, about half a billion dollars, and move that money into preschool and after-school education projects and community projects, which he says are some of the best ways to help to aid the people who are on sort of the losing end of that income inequality gap. And de Blasio has made this case very, very strongly. It has struck a chord by most accounts. He is leading in the polls. And it's quite clear that Mike Bloomberg doesn't like that.
Right. So in this interview, because I think you're right that the real fundamental focus here is the economic equity and opportunity questions, John Nichols. But I think that so in the interview, basically, really, really briefly, if you haven't read it, the other thing to add here is that Bill de Blasio, his wife is African American, and he has two biracial children that he is campaigning with, like pretty much any other politician who has a family. Probably will do some campaign events with them. And Bloomberg actually called de Blasio's campaign racist which is what's been garnering the most headlines. And then he actually leveled the class warfare charge. I think there are two really important things here to get into the Bloomberg mindset and the mindset really of a certain section of New York that is standing by and has no problem with this kind of rampant and escalating and really out of control income inequality in the city. Basically, with the notion of that de Blasio's exploiting the race card just by campaigning with his family. And then Bloomberg added that New York, to the extent there is a division in this city, it's that the wealthy pay for services for everybody else. Now, that sounds obnoxious on its face, but it's also...
This is also after he went on a whole rant about how A Tale of Two Cities is destructive for the city, and then he goes ahead and says that.
Right. De Blasio's campaign theme is A Tale of Two Cities. But that's really empirically wrong. What are the numbers behind that? And also, what do you think Bloomberg was trying to do with this, bringing this racial component in, which everybody's reacted to?
Well, so there's a lot of you packed a lot in that. Very good question.
There were two there, John. I'm for sure.
Of it.
sorry about
first
that.
First off, the racial component. It is, I think Bloomberg is bringing up the racial reality. I think he is, to be honest, in defense of Bloomberg, I think he was trying to talk politics there,
right,
and doing it very ineptly. It is true. There's simply no doubt that part of Bill de Blasio's appeal has been the incredible appeal of his family. And, the fact that his son, Dante, has appeared in very, very effective TV ads. And I think that, bizarrely enough, I think that bugged Bloomberg. I think I don't think that Bloomberg's particularly, I think that we have to be careful about suggesting that Bloomberg is, some sort of darkly evil figure who's, ranting about race and things like that. I think what he was kind of grumbling about is the fact that de Blasio has actually achieved something that, for lack of a better term, Bloomberg has a fascination with, has not been able to do himself well. Yeah. And that is to cross a lot of racial lines. But the way that Bloomberg did it was so ineffectual and so, I think, offensive to a lot of people. Saying that it's a racist campaign to highlight the fact that you have a diverse family. First off, as you well point out, just about every politician has their family out there. If they don't have their family out there, it's something that makes news. It's not news if you campaign with your family. But the fact that de Blasio really does have a family that, for lack of a better way of saying it, has allowed him to talk about some issues that not every candidate has been talking about and has been as effective on. Things like the stop and frisk law, some of the other issues of racial justice in New York City. De Blasio has crossed lines that other people don't. And so I just thought that Bloomberg was trying very ineptly to talk about politics there and to grumble about things. But I really do think the core of Bloomberg's remarks was that class warfare thing. I think that's where Bloomberg, it seems quite evident, is very, very upset. And Bloomberg has clearly, in his tenure, established a model for governance in New York that is very friendly to the very, very wealthy, and of which he is one. And it doesn't mean that he's been some sort of right-wing Scott Walker type or something like that, but it does mean that he has governed in a way that has really done very little to undermine the rush toward income inequality. And, in fact, we have seen the amount of revenues in New York City, the amount of money made in New York City that goes into the pocket of the very wealthy, expand dramatically over the last 30 years. And so de Blasio is saying, look, we should claw some of that back. And here's the two important factors in what Bloomberg was saying. Number one, when Mayor Bloomberg refers to the wealthy as the fortunate ones. That's his term he uses. The fortunate ones who pay the bills and who sort of like shoulder the weight of doing the city. You would think, wow, I mean, man, I must see the rich people just doing everything. The fact is the majority of revenues for New York City come from working people.
Right.
Not from the very, very wealthy. The wealthy pay a lot of taxes in New York. It's true. But they're not the ones shouldering the whole of the burden. And at the end of the day, and I think this is part of what de Blasio, and frankly, we should note some other candidates as well. De Blasio, I think, has had gotten the most traction on this, but some other candidates as well, pointing out that you've got a situation now in New York City where there are very, very wealthy people who pay a small portion of their income in taxes in New York City, where there are very, very poor people, tens of thousands of homeless people, who can't even get by. And in such an equation, in such a calculus, the idea of proposing a small tax increase is hardly radical. It's Franklin Roosevelt stuff.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, John Nichols, by the way, John Nichols joining us, politics writer for The Nation magazine. I think that that there's something really important here, though, that's symbolized by Bloomberg and by the eruption over what really is, as you point out, a pretty moderate tax increase proposal by Bill de Blasio. In the sense that and I think, again, precisely because Bloomberg has been good on some issues, but it's mm-hmm. this notion that there, when it comes to the marketplace, or when it comes, in Bloomberg's case, even to use the mechanism of government and state power to intervene pretty radically in public health and personal public health decisions. I would defend a lot of those policies, but they're pretty bold steps in terms of intervening in people's choices. The notion that in those areas, there's this complete realm of choice. There's a lot we can do, and we should let the evidence guide us. And then as soon as we get to talking about revenue and dealing with extreme economic inequality and making the most modest steps on taxes, that is, I mean, to borrow a phrase that's being thrown around a lot these days, that's a red line, and we can't cross it. There's something very disturbing about that juxtaposition, and that's at the heart of Bloomberg politics, it seems to me.
Well, I think that's at the heart of our American politics.
Yeah.
Remember, Mike Bloomberg, is I would say, arguably, in the middle of American politics, maybe even a little bit to the left of a lot of our national, you know, and the overall scheme of where our political center of gravity is. So, understand him as such. He is not merely speaking as himself, I don't think. I think he's speaking for a sort of a worldview that has become very, very popular in this age of austerity. And remember, austerity is where we say to, you know, working folks, look, the rich people have made a lot of money, they've lived large, now our budgets don't balance, so you have to pay for it.
Right.
And the working people say, well, hold it, well, what about the rich guy? And this is the calculus that de Blasio has brought into this race. It's why we're talking about it today. We're not talking about this race because New York City mayoral races are the only thing going on politically. In fact, there's an awful lot going on. But this primary tomorrow really does put some fundamental questions in play. And the fundamental questions that are in play in a city, our largest city, a city with, you know, so much going on, so much vibrance, and frankly, a city that in some ways has benefited from some of Mike Bloomberg's governance, is it possible in such a big governmental entity to create a more equitable circumstance? Not one that is totally fair to everybody or where everybody's got the same amount, but a situation where when you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of millionaires living in a city, but then also hundreds of thousands, you know, many, many hundreds of thousands of people living below the poverty level, can we address that to some extent? And what Bill de Blasio has said, which I think is, again, a renewal of an FDR, Harry Truman politics, hardly something all that radical, is, yes, it's possible. With tax policy, you can move some money from the very, very wealthy to programs that serve those with the least, especially children coming up. And we're going to see what happens. I mean, in a way, people should give Mike Bloomberg some measure of credit. He spoke very, very bluntly on the eve of an election. It stirred things up in a major way, and now the choices are very stark. It's very, very clear going into this primary. There could be a runoff election. There will be a general election. I think what Bloomberg was telescoping is what the opposition to de Blasio will be. It will be a little more sophisticated in its language, perhaps, but basically this notion that de Blasio is dangerous because he wants the tax. And so, in a way, I give Bloomberg credit for, you know, kind of laying out that opposition line. And now we're going to have elections, and people are going to have a choice on whether they want to continue with a political and economic model that, you know, seems to always come back to poor and working folks having to sacrifice while very wealthy people get dramatically wealthier, versus a model that's a little bit more respectful of the idea of equity.
Absolutely. And the other possibility that I'll just dangle out there is that maybe subconsciously Mike Bloomberg recognizes that Bill de Blasio should be the next mayor of New York City.
Isn't that an interesting concept?
But,
I can tell you this.
Yeah.
I can tell you this. I don't think in a Democratic primary, and in the rest of that interview, Mayor Bloomberg refers to de Blasio as a very populist, very left-wing kind of guy. I'm not sure that does a lot of damage in a New York Democratic Party.
Yeah, this is like de Blasio's closing argument for an – I mean, it couldn't have come at a better time, this kind of intervention from an electoral point of view. And I really briefly, too, before I get to the final question, in your article that you wrote for The Nation that I recommend everybody read called Mike Bloomberg and the Fortunate Ones versus Bill de Blasio, you say that de Blasio should follow FDR's lead in terms of welcoming their hatred. And that clip is part of the Majority Report intro on every show. So
I know it is. I've heard your show.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, the simple reality is that Franklin Roosevelt, one of the most successful presidents in American history and a man who continues to be revered for his ability to govern, and frankly, for his ability to make things better, not just for the poor and the working class, but also for a lot of wealthy people,
right.
Said to those who opposed his policies, it wasn't that he said he welcomed the hatred of the wealthy. He was himself wealthy, but he said he welcomed the hatred of those who would organize themselves politically to advance their already prosperous economic interest, rather than to respect the fact that there are fair and equitable ways to run a city, a state, a nation. And to my mind, I think that instead of getting overly cautious, being uncomfortable with what Bloomberg has said, that de Blasio and frankly other political figures in New York should respect that it's time to open up an old line of argument, which is that FDR argument. If people are going to attack you for wanting to tax, you know, big corporations in Wall Street, perhaps you should say, you bet.
Absolutely. And a final question, John Nichols, do you think there are national implications from this race?
Huge national implications. This is America's largest city. This is America's highest profile mayoralty. We know Mike Bloomberg because he's been mayor of New York. He's also a very successful businessman as well. But being mayor of New York is a big deal. It has been for generations. If an economic populist beats the other players, becomes mayor of New York, I think it's going to send very, very powerful messages, not just in New York and New York State, but across this country, that there may be a different way to talk about both politics and economics. And on the other hand, if he loses, if he gets beat in a scare campaign about taxation, I think that will push Democrats further into the corner of being Republican-lite. So this is an important race.
Yeah, I think that cannot be underscored enough as a New York voter. I think there's no question huge implications for the city and for the nation as a whole. John Nichols, de Blasio's taken care of. Now go stop the airstrikes on Syria.
Well, we'll certainly try and keep that debate going.
Thank you so much for joining us. John Nichols, political writer for the Nation.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.
So it matters, folks. It matters a lot.
And we'll be getting a little bit more into that Bloomberg interview
yeah.
the better half. It's quite that's the stuff that needed to be talked about that affects tomorrow's election in New York. But there's some other nuggets of insaneness in that interview.
This has Matt. Matt is this hit Matt's erogenous zone of outrage. A lot of parts of this Bloomberg interview. So we'll cover that in the better half.
But now
we have Chloe.
Chloe Angel of Feministing. She's going to join us, and we're going to, you know, break down Australia's new prime minister. He seems like a swell guy.
Yeah, we just played the Kevin Rudd clip the other day. Unfortunately, he lost. We're going to hear about the new prime minister of Australia. Matt's going to take over the helm here. We'll be right back in about 30 seconds. So stay tuned to Matt and Mike Monday on the Majority Report. Thanks, everybody. We'll be right back. To catch a body head for Houston once they caught us off guard. The Mac 10 was in the grass, and I ran like a cheetah with thoughts of an assassin. Pick the Mac up, your brother's back up. The Mac spit, lead was hit. One ran, I made a backflip. Heard a few chicks scream, my arms shook. Couldn't look, gave another squeeze. Heard it click, yo, my shit is stuck. Tried to cock it, it wouldn't shoot. Now I'm in danger. Finally pulled it back and saw three bullets caught up in the chamber. So now I'm jetting to the building lobby, and it was full of children. Probably couldn't see as high as I be. It's like the game ain't the same. Got younger pulling the triggers, bringing fame to their name and claim some corners. Cruise without upon us in broad daylight, stick up kids, they run upon us. 4.5s and gauges, max and facts, same to catch you back to back, snatching the cracks in black. There was a snitch on the block getting knocked, so hold your stash to the price drop. I know this crackhead who said she got a nice rock, and if it's good, you bring your customers a measurement price. But yo, you got a slot on a vacation, inside information keeps logged. Racing and they rhyme spacing. It drops deep as it does in my breath. I never sleep, cause sleep is the cousin of death. Beyond the walls of intelligence, life is defined. I think of crime when I'm in a New York state of mind. State of mind. I'm a gangster, drinking Moet, holding text, making sure the gas came correct. Then I step, investments and stock, sewing up the box to sell rocks. Winning gunfights with mega cops, but just a walking with his finger on the trigger. Make enough figures until my pockets get bigger. I ain't the type of brother made for you to start testing. Give me a Smith and Wesson, I have undressing. Thinking of cash flow, cooler and shelter. Whenever frustrated, I'm a hijack Delta. And the PJs, my blend tape plays, bullets and strays. Young is braids, each block is like a maze full of black rats trapped. Plus the island is packed. From what I hear in all the stories, when my people's come back black, I'm living where the nights is jet black. The fiends fight to get crack, I just max. I dream I can sit back and lamp like Capone. With truck strips on, all the legal luxury life. Rings flooded with stones, homes. I got so many bombs, I don't think I'm too sane. Life is parallel to hell, but I must maintain it be prosperous. Though we live dangerous, cops could just arrest me, blaming us for hell like hostages. It's only right that I was born to use mics, and the stuff that I write is even tougher than dice. I'm taking rappers to a new plateau, do rap slow. My rhyming is a vitamin, hell without a capsule. The smooth criminal on beat breaks. Never put me in your box if your shit eats tape. The city never sleeps, full of villains and creeps. That's where I learned to do my hustle, had to scuffle with freaks. I'm an addict for sneakers, 20s a Buddha and with beepers. In the streets I could reach her, about a teacher. Inhale deep like the words in my breath. I never sleep, cause sleep is the cousin of death. I lay puzzle as I backtrack to earlier times. Nothing's equivalent to the New York state of mind. State of mind. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks.
And I am Matt Binder. And joining us now, she is the editor of Feministing, Chloe Angel. And we're going to be discussing basically this past weekend with the Australian elections. Australia elected a new prime minister, Tony Abbott, and we'll be talking about him and his amazingness. I don't know how else to describe it. Thank you so much for joining us, Chloe.
Thank you for having me.
So, Chloe, let's before we get to Tony Abbott himself, let's discuss what I've been reading. What led to, I guess, him and his party, the Liberal National Coalition, which is the Conservative Party over in Australia, and
just to make things nice and clear, that's how we do things.
So the Conservative Party over there is called the Liberal Party, and the I guess what would be closest to a left wing or the Democrats over there would be the Labour Party. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Although there's not a whole lot of daylight between them on the political spectrum, I would say.
I can give you some
brief background, since not so much because I know that Americans are fully aware of everything that goes on in the political spheres outside of their own country. Right?
Oh, of course.
So basically, Kevin Rudd and the Labour Party were elected in 2007 in what counts as a landslide where I come from, in 2007, after about 11 years of Liberal government, and after some shambolic business in the first 3 years of his term, he was replaced as the leader of the Labour Party by his deputy prime minister, Julia Gillard, mm-hmm. in early 2010. And then she was properly elected. She was elected later that year in a federal election in 2010.
And she was Australia's first female prime minister, correct?
She was Australia's first woman prime minister. Which is a big deal, and ended sexism forever in the Western country, obviously.
Just like how Barack Obama ended racism here, yeah.
Exactly. Cue another three shambolic years, unfortunately. There was what's called a leadership spill, which is a reshuffling of who is running the party earlier this year. Kevin Rudd, who had been foreign minister for a couple of years, but who had never really, it was clear, was not very happy with that situation and was angling for the leadership for the whole time that he was out of power, was once again made leader of the Labour Party earlier this year. And on Saturday, the Labour Party lost big time. So thanks to the time difference here in the States, I got to wake up. As it always happens, I get to wake up to the news of who our new leader is in Australia, which is not a particularly pleasant feeling, by the way.
I can imagine. So let's bring up with Kevin Rudd. I mean, just a few days ago, he was sort of, I guess, having some sort of name value here in the States, because there was a video going around where it went viral online, at least, where he basically stood up for same-sex marriage in Australia. This pastor, Christian pastor, asked him a question, and basically it was great. I mean, everyone was sharing it. It seemed like, you know, we could have, I mean, over in New Zealand, Australia's neighbors, they just basically legalized same-sex marriage, and maybe that could have happened in Australia. But now we have this new prime minister, Tony Abbott, who defeated Kevin Rudd, and it's looking like that may not be happening anytime soon in Australia.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. What's interesting to me is that the way that Americans seem to become aware of Australian politicians is through viral videos. I mean, most people will remember the amazing, about 15-minute viral video of Julia Gillard last year going to town on Tony Abbott and on the sexist climate generally, the misogynist climate of the opposition party last year. Do you remember that video that just rocketed around the world?
Yes, exactly. I remember it. I remember all 15 minutes of it.
Yeah, so basically, viral videos seem to be our main contribution to the global political discourse.
It's unfortunate.
But Kevin Rudd had a Josiah Bartlett moment last week. He offered a very Christian defense of marriage equality in the face of during a question time, you know, a town hall meeting where a self-professed Christian was talking about, you know, going with or going against the Bible in support for same-sex marriage, And yeah, it was an international sensation. It was not enough to save him and save the party, unfortunately. But then again, nothing was going to be. This has been Saturday's result has been a fait accompli for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into the man himself, the new Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott. I just have I pulled a few quotes of his, and I just thought I would read a few of these quotes to basically, I think.
Wait. I know exactly which quotes these are going to be. It's going to be the one about virginity being a precious gift. It's going to be, the one about abortion being the easy way out. And, it's probably going to be one about marriage equality, right?
Well, you got two for three. The other one I was going to read was his analysis on climate change, which is climate change is absolute crap.
The really disappointing thing about that is that Australia, and there was a very lengthy article about this in Rolling Stone a couple of years ago, Australia, when the seas start to rise, or continue to rise rather, we are going to be so incredibly screwed. We are just going to be so incredibly screwed. Something like 80% of our population lives on the coast. We're a very low-lying country. We're the oldest, flattest, driest continent in the world. We're going to be totally screwed by climate change. I mean, we're already totally screwed by climate change. And
us New Yorkers can meet the Australians at the bottom of the ocean when climate change is there.
Yeah, and I mean, look, one of the great things about the Labor Party, although, and I'm going to use the word shambolic here again, because the Labor Party couldn't get it back together on carbon trading and on a climate change policy. But one of the great things was that we really did seem to be moving toward a position where we, unlike a lot of politicians in the United States, acknowledge that climate change is real, that it is caused by man, and that it's going to pose a real environmental, economic, and human rights problem in the next century, assuming we all survive into the next century. Mm. And that's, you know, that just doesn't look like that's going to be the case for Australia anymore, and that's really disappointing. But Tony Abbott, not the most progressive guy on gender.
Yeah, let's get to that. Yes.
He also has had a tendency in this campaign. By the way, the campaign lasts for 5 weeks, which, given that we are already talking about 2016 here in the States, 5 weeks sounds like a quickie, really. Whereas the American option is more like tantric sex.
Voting is also mandatory in Australia, right?
Voting is mandatory.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing for me, what was really interesting about Abbott was watching him use his daughters, his two daughters who are in their late early 20s, use them as political props during the campaign. Which is not to say that they aren't, you know, free-acting humans; they're clearly there by choice. But it's been really interesting to watch him sort of strategically deploy women in his family as proof that he doesn't have a women problem, which, you know, that's sort of like saying, you know, my one black friend loves me.
Exactly. Yes. So let's discuss, there was one moment that was getting a little bit of even here in the States, it was getting a little bit of traction, was his quote about one of his fellow candidates, having a bit of sex appeal.
Yeah, look, Tony Abbott has a woman problem. Tony Abbott cannot seem to talk about women or about gender without, you know, putting his foot in his mouth. And that's partly a function of the fact that he lives in Australia, which has a woman problem. And it's partly a function of the fact that Australian politics generally is really sexist. I mean, if you look at the way that Julie Gillard was talked about and treated in political coverage and by, you know, by her people in her party and people outside of her party who opposed her, it's pretty clear that, you know, simply electing a woman prime minister doesn't erase your sexism problem. And Tony Abbott has had a series of those moments talking about women, whether they're in his own family, in his party, whether it's about the women to whom he's providing paid parental leave. This, to me, is the heartbreaking thing about one of the heartbreaking things about Abbott is that he has There's this push to, you know, provide paid parental leave to Australian families, and it comes, you know, that's great. That's a good idea. That is a great idea, and it comes couched in, cloaked in all this sexism, and it's, you know, for someone who is pro paid parental leave, it puts you in this very difficult situation where, you know, you want, well, you want one thing, and how much you want, I guess you want the candy, how much crap are you willing to take with it to get it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I have a quote here. I mean, even when he's discussing, like you said, you know, you just mentioned paid leave, and then on Rights at Work, I have this quote here: "Bad bosses, like bad fathers and husbands, should be tolerated because they do more good than harm." I mean, simply unbelievable.
Yeah. Like I said, Tony Abbott has a woman problem, and now women have a Tony Abbott problem.
That's a great way to put it. And he's great on same-sex marriage, too. You know, just like Kevin Rudd, standing up there and speaking for the rights of all people, right?
Sorry, you just cut out there for a second. What did you say?
Oh, I said how, and he's great on same-sex marriage, too, just like Kevin Rudd, right?
No, not really. But the good news is that both parties have terrible asylum seeker policies.
Oh, really?
So there's that. Look, I mean, one of my friends, Rachel Hill, who is she's a political journalist, she's also Australian, and the way she put it was that Saturday's result was sort of like breaking up with someone when you know the relationship is bad for you and bad for them, but you really don't want to go out with the other guy. But, you know you have to end this unhealthy relationship. And the honest to God truth is that the last couple of years of Labor government have been utterly shambolic. That's now the third time I've used that word, so you know I mean it.
Yes.
And, you know, my feeling when I went in to vote at the Aussie consulate here in New York last week was that it's a lesser of two evils situation. There really weren't any good options in this election, especially if you care about LGBT rights, if you care about gender equity, if you care about asylum seekers. There were really no good options in this election. It's a pretty bleak situation.
So Australia is just like America in that sense, you know? I mean, really.
It's interesting. It's been interesting to be mired in American election cycles for a couple of years, and to watch Australia become more like America, at least in how we run our campaigns. You know, in Australia, when people accuse people of American style politics, that's not a compliment. There's been a lot of focus on theatrics and not a lot on substance, and that is a pretty American trait, I would say, and not one that I want to see my home country aspiring to.
I mean, when you look at so many of these major industrialized countries, I mean, you see that they're becoming more leftist, progressive, on many issues, and then you take a look at, I guess, Australia now and the United States. And it couldn't be any more the opposite. I mean, looking at some of these quotes from Tony Abbott, it really would not surprise me to see these quotes being attributed to a Republican here, or some of these even Democrats here.
Yeah, you know, that's true. But it's not, you know, despite what I said earlier, I wouldn't say it's universally bleak. I mean, I think if for no other reason than we have at least had a woman head of state, we've at least had elected a woman head of state. I think it's as is the case with progress in the state, it's a case of two steps forward, one step back, and there are always exceptional people. You know, Penny Wong, who is the Australian finance minister under the Labor Party, I guess she'll now be probably shadow finance minister. She's an openly gay Australian of Asian descent.
Oh, awesome.
Who you know, has been very open about her about having a kid while she's in office. I mean, she's a trailblazer in multiple ways, and you know, and you see bright spots like that here and in Australia. And despite what the prevailing mood is, there are always, I think, spots of hope like that.
Mm-hmm. Chloe, Michael.
Tony Abbott, piece of work.
This is Michael Brooks here. I just had a quick question for you. What about the Green Party in Australia? I had seen a couple of years ago that it seemed like they had made some progress. They were in coalition, I thought, with the Labour Party, at least briefly. What kind of factor do they play now in Australian politics, now and moving forward?
You know, I think they play this role of sort of tempting more progressive-minded would-be Labour voters. I think there are people who would love to see them become a legitimate third party option, because their policies are in keeping with a lot of American progressives found themselves transplanted into Australia, they would find themselves voting for the Green Party. But it's also not, when it comes to electing people who will actually be governing, in a meaningful way, they're not yet a viable option. Although, as you say, they've been gaining influence and momentum in the last decade or so. I think what the Green Party does is serve as a wish list for people who have to choose between idealism and pragmatism.
Right.
Chloe Angel, editor of Feministing. Thanks so much for joining us today. I believe we'll have a number of Americans listening to this program who don't usually pay to Australian politics get more into it, or at least I hope. Things are happening.
Thank you so much. It's been really nice talking to you guys.
Thank you, Chloe.
Have a good one.
You too.
I find this to be fascinating. I'm sure our smart Majority Report listeners will also.
We have some Majority Report fellows and folks in Australia. So this one also goes out to you.
Yes. I'm sure that is the basics, though. They are probably...
I'm sure they're already quite informed and quite depressed about the result of this election.
I just was reading. Like, I honestly didn't even... Pardon my ignorance, but didn't even know there was an election coming up with the... until that Kevin Rudd clip came out, like Chloe mentioned, how that's really what made a lot of people aware. But I was just reading some of Tony Abbott's quotes, and I just couldn't... I couldn't believe how much he sounded like American Republicans.
Well, and then there was that woman running that we played the clip a couple weeks ago of the Australian Sarah Palin running on
anti-Muslim
platform. So there's these
I mean,
these funny parallels.
When I think of countries like the UK, Germany, Australia, you know, countries that are, you know, Western industrialized nations – I think of, you know, they're more progressive than the States.
Well, I'm certainly on social issues.
I guess we have a friend in Australia.
We're amigos in Australia. So we're gonna move to the better half of the program.
We are. We just gave you a taste of New York City and a taste of Australia. We took you to New York City. We took you to the Empire State. And then we took you to the land down under, all within 50 minutes. Now, if that's not a reason to become a member and support Matt and Mike Mondays today on the Majority Report, then I honestly, I cannot imagine what is. I mean, you're going to turn on your TV and you're going to find out tons and tons of commentary from pundits saying the same things about Syria. And while Syria is very important, and we are definitely going to get to Syria in today's better half, which you would be able to listen to if you were a member, it's also good to be aware that there are other things going on in the world.
And the relevance of New York across the country, the relevance of Australia, how this is all interdependent. Become a member today. Short of that, buy anything you need on Amazon through our Amazon link at the Majority homepage, at the Majority Report homepage. JustCoffee.coop is a great way of getting fair trade, ethically produced coffee that is delicious and supports the Majority Report. Like us on Facebook. You'll be able to keep up with our shows, our videos, and we even interact with you. Sometimes people send us nice comments and messages, and we send nice comments and messages back.
You can also
follow us on Twitter.
And
subscribe to our YouTube channel.
All that fun stuff. Coffee at Just Co-op. Justcoffee.coop. Use coupon code Majority. And I'm opening up the IM system right now. If you're an app beta tester, You can IM us straight from the app. Otherwise, you know the legacy Majority Report IMs. I believe the universal one you can use is majorityfm@jabber.org. There is also, you can also call into the show at 646-257-3920. That is 646-257-3920. The app will be coming soon. Possibly this week, very likely this week. We would like to schedule some, once we know the app has been approved by Apple, we would like to schedule it so we can all, as a group, Majority Report listeners, download at the same time, help us move up those app rankings.
As a Majority Report, as a Majority Report nation, we're a small enlightened nation.
As a collective,
we're like Costa Rica or something. All right.
What do we got coming up in the better half?
Better half. So breaking news, which I'm going to go over. Russia has just proposed a deal where Syria would give up its chemical stockpiles.
We'll get into the specifics.
Which we'll get to the specifics of that in the better half.
We also have Assad had an interview today with Charlie Rose on CBS.
Yeah, so we'll play you a clip of that, talk about that. And also going to get into the role that anarchists are playing in the Syrian opposition. What else do we have?
We have the two very interesting NSA stories. One where they could look into your smartphones, people. iPhones, Android devices, Blackberries. They can do that. Also, the Obama administration is not just like Bush on the NSA issue. They're actually a bit worse, being that they rolled back a number of restrictions. And then we also have a story about a feminist group that is run by a man.
And you might be able to guess which feminist group this is because it involved a lot of shirtlessness.
Yes.
And we will get to all of that and more in the better half of the show. Stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back in a second.